Hackers don't charge through your firewall anymore. They send cleverly written emails from someone you may know with a link or an attachment that might be relevant to your job description.
The New York Times is barraged by a Chinese cyber assault. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. One musician hears his work on the Fox TV show Glee and is blown away, but not in a good way.
It was a note-for-note copy of my arrangement, and nobody had ever contacted me. And my first thought was, they can't possibly be doing this, can they?
Plus, NPR tweeter extraordinaire Andy Carvin on the challenges of reporting the whole story of the Arab Spring.
I would hear from supporters of protesters saying, how dare you retweet that government minister? You're buying into their propaganda.
All that and more coming up next.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. If a dog bites a man, it's not a story. But if a dog bites a journalist, as security technologist Bruce Schneier has observed, it's front page news. Well, in this analogy, consider the dog to be Chinese hackers who hack institutions of all sorts all the time. But this week, when the New York Times revealed that it had been penetrated by Chinese hackers, and so had Bloomberg News, it was a huge story, swiftly followed by the Wall Street Journal's revelation that it, too, had been hacked. It seems to be a badge of honor, like being on Nixon's enemies list. Anyway, apparently the Times hacking was sparked by the paper's coverage of Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao's wealthy relatives. But Times technology reporter Nicole Perlroth says that despite the hacking, no sources were compromised.
That story was actually sourced through publicly available documents. There was no deep throat. There was no sensitive sourcing. It really was what we're calling a misbegotten search.
But the Times allowed them to, quote, spin a digital web, you wrote, for 4 months. Was Mandiant, the security company the Times hired, really able to track the hackers?
The days leading up to the publication of our Wen story, we had gotten warnings that the story may have consequences. So we asked AT&T to look for unusual activity on our network, and lo and behold, AT&T came back to us and said, at least three of your computers are communicating with command and control servers that we have in the past seen launch attacks on companies in the U.S. defense sector. We then notified the FBI. We replaced every computer that had been compromised. We tried to block any communication between those known command and control servers, and we thought that had done the trick. A week later, you know, we continued to see activity in our systems, particularly on election night. After that, on November 7th, we hired Mandiant. We spent the last 3 months watching to see where the hackers were installing backdoors, what malware they were installing, which computers had been compromised, what they were after, most importantly. Once we had a good grasp, we blocked the malware, shut down communication with the command and control servers, erected defenses, and then we went public with it.
And how long is that going to protect you?
Well, I think we were clear about this. We're on alert. This is an ongoing effort. Part of the reason that we went public with this was to educate our own employees about how easy it is for hackers to get into our systems. Hackers don't charge through your firewall anymore. They send cleverly written emails from someone you may know with a link or an attachment that might be relevant to your job description. These emails are extremely targeted.
Didn't you note in your piece that one hacker got into a system through a thermostat?
Right. So in 2011, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce had been attacked by Chinese hackers in a month-long cyber campaign. And the chamber worked with the FBI to seal up its systems. And then months later, it recognized that a printer in its office had been acting erratically, printing out documents in Chinese characters. I know, it just sounds like something from a thriller. Then it noticed that, this is even better, a thermostat in one of its corporate apartments was acting erratically. And when it sent someone in to check, it noticed that this thermostat was communicating with an IP address in China. It's just mind-boggling.
Isn't the moral of this story that if you close a window, they'll come in through the door? If you close the door, they'll come in through the roof. If you seal the roof, they'll come up through the basement. In other words, you can run, but you really can't hide?
You're right. But once they do get in, you want to prevent them from moving around. So they come in through the roof, you want to make sure that the flue is closed. You're basically expecting that they're going to come in, and you set up your defenses in such a way that your most valuable intellectual property is protected.
What about the criticism that some have that, you know, this is going on everywhere, every human rights organization, every corporation, and you don't really get this kind of coverage until they come up and bite the New York Times?
Well, that's sort of the challenge of my job. People are very reticent to say that they have been hacked for fear of what it will do to their reputations or to their stock price. In the last couple of years, there's been a little change in the wind. So in 2010, Google was the first to come forward when they sort of withdrew their operation from China and said that they had done so because Chinese hackers had penetrated the Gmail accounts of human rights activists. They said as part of that announcement that some 30 other companies were hacked in the same campaign. Of those 30, only two came forward, Adobe and Intel, but they didn't provide any details. Later, RSA came forward. Hackers had gone after their crown jewels, which was the algorithm for these secure ID tokens that are used by Booz Allen and Lockheed Martin. They really were left with no choice but to announce that they had been hacked. Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman have now been much more open about the fact that they are targeted on an almost daily basis. Now, I have been trying to get these companies to let me do a TikTok of the attacks, but none of these corporations want to be the guinea pig. The fact that we were hacked did present an opportunity where we could sort of show the world how this happens and just how easy it is.
Nicole, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
New York Times technology reporter Nicole Perlroth.
On Thursday in Portland, Oregon, a 21-year-old Somali American who had talked about the glories of, quote, jihad, was convicted of federal terrorism charges. His lawyers claimed that he'd been led to act, that is, entrapped by the FBI. That argument failed this week, but it's become an increasingly common refrain. Journalist Trevor Aronson has researched 158 cases of accused terrorists apprehended through FBI stings. In his new book, The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism, he finds that since 9/11, the U.S. government is responsible for, quote, hatching and financing more terrorist plots in the United States than any other group.
There are 15,000 registered informants working for the FBI today, which is an unprecedented number. There are informants in every community large enough to support a mosque. Some work for the FBI for money. You can make $100,000 or more per case. In other cases, the informants are coerced into cooperating through the fear of deportation or through FBI saying, if you work with us, we'll make this criminal charge go away.
There's a piece in Mother Jones magazine excerpting your book, The Terror Factory, that begins with a guy who wants to create mayhem but hasn't the wherewithal.
Sure. That was the case of a man named Kwasi Nafis. Nafis was a Bangladeshi student here in the U.S. He had just arrived in January of 2012, and he meets an informant and explains to him that he's interested in committing an act of terrorism. The informant introduces him to an undercover agent posing as an Al-Qaeda operative, and Nafis explains that he wants to strike at the heart of the American capitalist system and then says, well, no, maybe we should bomb the New York Federal Reserve building. And the FBI brings in the chemicals they need for this bomb that they'll load up in a van that is also provided by the FBI, and they get Nafis to then drive the van with the undercover agent in front of the Federal Reserve building of New York. He and the FBI agent walk to a hotel room, and he dials on a cell phone, expecting it to blow up and destroy the Federal Reserve building, kill hundreds, if not thousands, of people in and around New York. Of course, that never happens. FBI agents rush in and arrest him. He's an example of someone who never had the capacity for terrorism on his own. It was the FBI that provided everything he needed to go from a disgruntled student to a deadly terrorist.
Now, in your book, you point out that after the United States invasion of Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda structurally became incapable of mounting a plot such as 9/11 and changed its strategy to enabling lone wolves to pull off terror plots. These guys who the FBI have infiltrated are exactly the kind of lone wolves that Osama bin Laden meant to send out into the world. Why should we not be fearful of them?
In these FBI terrorism stings, we're really finding people on the fringes of society. You know, many are financially desperate. Others are mentally ill. On their own, they never have the capability to commit an act of terrorism. There have been dangerous and deadly lone wolves. You know, if you look at Faisal Shahzad, he delivered a car bomb to Times Square. It was smoking. A street vendor saw it, and fortunately, it didn't go off. The FBI had no knowledge of him. The FBI has had a difficult, if not impossible, time teasing out people who are the real terrorists.
The implication of your book is that it's really all about the press conference. It's all about making us feel like the FBI has our back.
You know, every year the FBI gets $3 billion to fund its counterterrorism program. It's the largest portion of its budget. What the FBI has done very effectively is play the media. When there's an announcement of a sting operation, it's played on the front page as another terrorist plot foiled. But it often takes days and sometimes longer than that before the media realizes, well, this wasn't all it was portrayed to be. In fact, the person never had connections to Al-Qaeda. He never was a real terrorist were it not for the FBI providing him with the means. This has allowed the FBI to portray the threat of Islamic terrorism in the United States as much greater than it is through a rather complicit media delivering that message.
You say that the media narrative itself seems to be turning against the FBI.
Absolutely. Foreign Policy magazine had a blog item a few months ago that said, how many idiot jihadis can the FBI fool? What also has happened is these cases have come to trial in many cities, and the media are now seeing that these were people that were empowered by FBI informants, and that left to their own devices, the evidence suggested they weren't going to do anything.
Are we in the end safer because we've got $3 billion per year going towards counterterrorism that yields some clown defendants? Or is it all a mirage?
I think it's both. They're creating an environment where perhaps a real terrorist would begin to question everyone he's collaborating with. He'd begin to think, well, is that person a government agent? Is that person an informant? That is perhaps a beneficial effect to these sting operations in the counterterrorism mission. But the mirage effect is that the people that are ultimately charged with terrorism, left to their own devices, they would have continued to be a Walmart stalker. In one case, the target of the sting tells the informant who's providing him with all the capability, if it wasn't for you, I probably would have just ended up stabbing someone with a steak knife. I can also say, and the data shows this, that as the FBI has pursued Islamic terrorism with such a singular focus, they've lost focus on other threats, such as the sovereign citizen movement and the white supremacist movement, who, since 9/11, have actually killed more people than Islamic terrorists.
All right, Trevor. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Trevor Aronson is a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University and author of The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism.
Coming up, the content industry's softer, gentler approach to piracy.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Starting in the next couple of months, five of the country's largest Internet service providers, AT&T, Cablevision, Comcast, Time Warner Cable, and Verizon, will implement what is called the Copyright Alert System, known colloquially as Six Strikes. In the works for over a year, the system is meant to create an escalating series of penalties for serial illegal downloaders. Jill Lesser is the executive director of the Center for Copyright Information, which is a collaboration between organizations like the Motion Picture Association of America and the Recording Industry Association of America with the ISPs to implement the copyright alert system. Jill, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
The system works by content holders joining peer-to-peer networks in order to monitor what kind of material is being illegally downloaded, right? And then what happens?
And then they identify individual files and send notices to internet service providers who then pass those notices on to their customers in the form of copyright alerts.
What do these alerts look like?
So the initial alerts inform the primary account holder that somebody made content available illegally over their internet connection. They explain to the consumer how this might have happened and what the consumer can do to ensure it doesn't happen again.
Like what?
Like ensuring their wireless connection is password protected. They also provide links to authorize legal ways for you to find that content.
Okay. You've got your first alert, which you described, and the second alert is basically similar to the first. And then the third alert and the fourth alert are also similar to those educational messages, but they will appear in a conspicuous manner, and that will require the user to acknowledge that you've gotten the alert. Then you get to the fifth alert, and this refers to so-called mitigation measures.
So the mitigation measures are intended to really get people's attention. They range from putting a user through a copyright tutorial, you know, what is copyright, how have you potentially engaged in illegal behavior, to a couple of day reduction in internet speed, depending on the ISP.
And so far I understand there are no plans by any of the ISPs to include actually disconnecting users from the internet as part of the punishments. But Verizon will slow the internet speed to potentially 256 kilobytes per second, which is basically unusable by any modern internet standard. So isn't that the same?
No, it really isn't the same. The reduction of speed, which one or more of the ISPs will be using as a mitigation measure, is, first of all, it's only 48 hours, which is far from termination. I think at the point that you have received, this is your fifth copyright alert, you have acknowledged two of them, and you are still engaging in copyright infringement, then that person might need an extra, you know, you really need to stop.
I wanted to ask you, though, about the people who may feel that they're being wrongly accused. The appeals process involves a $35 fee, which would be refunded if the appealer wins. Is this to keep people from filing nuisance appeals?
I think it is intended certainly to discourage frivolous appeals. It is, as you said, refunded if successful, and it is also waivable if someone can't afford it.
What happens if you get 7, 8, and 9 strikes?
We hope that by the time people get to alerts number 5 or 6, they will stop. Once they've been mitigated, they've received several alerts, we're just not going to send them any more alerts because they're not the kind of customer that we're going to reach with this program.
So what happens to them?
Nothing under this program.
So either they get sued by someone or you stop mitigating and you just give up and walk away.
Exactly. But let me just say this. If we reach consumers where they can hear us, you know, this is what this means and this is how you can find content in a legal way, we hope we will actually not be sending a lot of fifth and sixth notices.
As you've described it, the copyright alert system, it's unlikely to stop or even catch the worst offenders because those knowledgeable offenders will use virtual private networks and they'll figure out ways to avoid detection.
There are certainly other ways that content owners address those issues, but for us, it is reaching the casual infringer, which is a large percentage of peer-to-peer piracy.
You know, the Recording Industry Association of America filed 20,000 lawsuits against infringers that it said was meant to, quote, educate, but it didn't end up slowing piracy at all.
It's been at least 5 years since suing individuals was really a strategy of the industry. I think part of the reason why they came to the table to do this kind of a voluntary educational effort is in the hopes of having a different kind of approach and one that says to consumers, this behavior needs to stop, but also helps consumers, number one, understand why, and number two, find what they're looking for in a legal authorized way.
Wouldn't it have been great if this had all happened 5 years ago or 10?
I think we would be in a different place, yes.
Jill, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Jill Lesser is the executive director of the Center for Copyright Information.
So who are these average, everyday downloaders of songs and movies? Until recently, we didn't know much about them, what they did, or how they felt about it. Enter the Copy Culture Survey, one of the most extensive studies of digital media sharing to date. Turns out about 14% of Americans get the majority of their music and movies illegally, but close to 50% have obtained some content illicitly, and that number rises sharply if you're 18 to 29 years old. Joe Karaganis is one of the authors of the Copy Culture Survey, and he says that on the question of attitudes towards file sharing, the pirates have some surprisingly nuanced views.
Most of our findings suggest that people understand copyright as a set of trade-offs between creators and the public. Creators deserve rights of exploitation of the work they create, but at some point it's also valuable for ideas and creative work to circulate. The more it circulates, the more it enriches us in general and creates incentives for new work. This is sort of the bargain inherent in copyright. Most people recognize that trade-off and struggle with it. We did find that most people simply don't view infringement as a serious offense. You know, only 52% of the people in our U.S. survey supported penalties of any kind for the downloading of a single movie or film. And then when you begin to break it down into the types of penalties that people think are appropriate, most of them will say that fines are an appropriate step, warnings are an appropriate step. Very few of them will propose stronger penalties, things like throttling your bandwidth so that your internet is slower, or disconnection from the internet.
And as they download a film or a song, are they considering it a guilty pleasure? Do they feel some sense of mischief? What is their attitude about what their behavior actually is?
Basically, we find that there's a kind of public-private distinction that runs through attitudes toward copying and sharing. So in general, there's a high degree of tolerance of sharing among friends and family, and quite a bit less tolerance for sharing through large-scale file-sharing services. So the catch, of course, is that for people under 30, for people who've grown up with Facebook and other social media, friends has become a very elastic concept. So that's really where the law is beginning to bump up against some very significant changes in how people interact and how they build their communities through, among other things, the sharing of media.
How did your respondents react to the idea of having their individual ISPs monitoring their online behavior?
Well, this, for me, was one of the most interesting findings of the study. There is majority support for copyright enforcement online. But the more conflicts you introduce into those questions, the lower support goes. If you ask the question, would you support enforcement if it meant over-enforcement? Then you're already down to a 37% support rate. And under all existing models, filtering of content is over-filtering. There is no model that perfectly captures infringing material because what constitutes infringement is very much in flux and very often debatable.
One of the conflicts that we see when we talk about things like regulating file sharing is the conflict between the practical means of limiting this kind of online behavior and the surveillance methods that it takes to follow what people are up to. Can this ever be reconciled?
This is really the question that comes up in looking at the copyright alert system. The copyright alert system engages in surveillance of certain kinds of internet use. If you're using a peer-to-peer network, it's very likely to flag you and you may get a warning as a result. But everybody knows that that will simply drive people to other less observable forms of file sharing. There are streaming systems. You can share face-to-face. You can share through Dropbox. You can share through email. And so the enforcement question becomes, how much further do you want to go to surveil other kinds of internet activity and other forms of use of people's computers? So I'm less concerned about the copyright alert system than I am about what happens after it fails. The fact that it's almost guaranteed to fail to produce the kind of impact that its proponents want just sets up the next conversation, and now we've set a precedent for surveilling people's activity. We think people value privacy higher than they value copyright enforcement.
Clearly, the people you surveyed are conflicted as to what to do and what the society should do. But one thing they seem to show is that they're willing to pay for the opportunity to have universal access along the lines of a Netflix model. Can you give me more details?
Sure. Well, we found that there's, in general, a very high willingness to pay for legal, convenient media. And in fact, highest among those people who do the most file sharing. This has turned into a bit of a hot potato as people pick up the report because it doesn't conform to some of the ideas about what piracy is. for most of the last decade, there just weren't very good means of music discovery and, you know, the possibility of a kind of universal jukebox, that's beginning to change. So people who, in our survey, said, yes, they pirate, also said that they do so less because of the emergence of these legal means of discovery and listening to large databases of music.
Joe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joe Karaganis is Vice President of the American Assembly, a public policy institute at Columbia University. And now a content theft in plain sight that may be legal, but just feels wrong. In 2005, Jonathan Colton quit his job writing software to devote himself to music. One of his first big successes was his own arrangement of Sir Mix-a-Lot's pop rap classic, Baby Got Back. 8 years later, his exact arrangement ended up uncredited on the Fox TV show Glee. Colton wasn't compensated, but he certainly was weirded out. Jonathan, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
All right, the song is Baby Got Back. We're going to play the original Sir Mix-a-Lot version.
I like big butts and I cannot lie. You other brothers can't deny that when a girl walks in with an itty-bitty waist and a round thing in your face, you get sprung.
So you like that song, but you could improve that.
Far be it from me to question Sir Mix-a-Lot's take on that song, but I do like the song. I find it to be a message of empowerment about body image. So I did a style of that song that is slow and sensitive and folky and extremely white.
I like big butts and I cannot lie. You other brothers can't deny. When a girl walks in with an itty bitty waist and a round thing in your face, you get sprung.
That is definitely white.
And I like to think there's another level where I'm commenting a little bit on the history of white musicians appropriating music from black musicians and maybe not fully understanding what they're doing.
So you dropped that cover years ago, and a few weeks ago, this other version of Baby Got Back showed up on the internets.
I like big butts and I cannot lie. You other brothers can't deny. When a girl walks in with a nitty bitty waist and a round thing in your face, you get sprung.
It was a note for note copy of my arrangement, and nobody had ever contacted me. And my first thought was, they can't possibly be doing this, can they?
How long did it take you to ask that same question of a lawyer?
The very first thing I did was get in touch with my lawyers to find out what the legalities of the situation were. And of course, at that time, there was no real proof that it was definitely going to appear on the episode because that was just a fan website. It appeared to be a leak of the song and not an official release.
And Fox, of course, got wind of you looking into it, and the song never appeared on Glee, right?
That is not what happened. and it did, in fact, air on the episode, seemingly unchanged from the version that was leaked.
And if you were looking for a smoking gun, you, in your original version, watermarked it in a way by using your name, Johnny C. And when the song shows up on Glee, lo and behold,
there it is. And what's hilarious is that the character singing the song is named Adam. So I'm not sure why it's in there.
When you put this up on the internet, what were the copyright conditions under which you posted it?
Well, I released this song under the standard cover license that's available to anybody. I have copyright over the master recording, which is to say the audio file itself. As far as the song goes, that part belongs to Sir Mix-a-Lot. And actually, there's a clause in the copyright code that covers this license that says the arrangement does not receive its own copyright protection. If you ask different lawyers, you get different answers about how true that is. We're still sort of looking into that, and I don't fully understand all the implications at this point.
So could this be a case in which Fox, strictly speaking, didn't break any laws or steal any intellectual property, but just showed a transcendent lack of self-respect?
Your words, not mine. The thing that my lawyers have become more interested in is the idea that they may have actually used my audio in the track. Some fans of mine have done some amateur sleuthing and uncovered a few artifacts that seem like they could not have gotten there other than by them using my tracks. If they did, in fact, use my audio, that is a pretty clear violation of copyright.
Fox, the network, hasn't commented publicly, but you did hear from the producers of the show?
I heard from someone on the music side of Glee who, a few hours before the show aired, called my agent and said, we're within our rights to do this. We would hope that he would see it as a positive thing that he could capitalize on. And really, he should be grateful for the exposure that this is going to give him. Now, of course, it's hard to claim that you are giving someone exposure when you have not mentioned their name anywhere. The way I sort of read this is that this is a policy created by a pack of Fox attorneys. I don't have any quarrel with the creative people at Glee or with the Glee fans or anything. I suspect there are probably a lot of people on that side who wish that this had gone differently as well.
Now, this bizarre little story has just the most delicious twist. Tell me what you did.
So many of my fans have been expressing this sympathetic rage online. So I tried to think of a way to positively channel all of this energy. And what I did was I released a new version of my original cover version of Sir Mix-a-Lot's song as a single on iTunes. I called it Baby Got Back in the Style of Glee. And it is exactly the same recording as my original recording. And from now until the end of February, all the profits I will donate to the It Gets Better Project and the VH1 Save the Music Foundation, two causes that are pretty closely associated with the message of Glee and with the fans who enjoy it.
And how's it selling?
Much to my surprise and delight, I believe it actually cracked the top 100 selling songs on iTunes, which is amazing and hilarious.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Colton is a musician and an involuntary contributor to the Fox program Glee. We asked Fox for a comment, but the network declined.
Coming up, how the man who tweets revolutions reports from the field when he's thousands of miles away.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to ensure the development of innovative, safe, and effective drugs and medical devices at PewTrust.org. The Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in American culture. PoetryFoundation.org. And the Cy Sims Foundation, supporter of the Cy Sims School of Business at Yeshiva University, at CySimsFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Throughout the months of the Arab Spring, the Twitter feed of NPR senior strategist Andy Carvin was a one-stop shop for news on the ground, flooding the ether with tweets and links, photos and video, and the characters' courage, controversy, and rage that is the stuff of revolution moment to moment. Blogger and City University of New York professor Jeff Jarvis called Andy Carvin the prototype of a new kind of journalist. Media critic and Guardian columnist Michael Wolff called him a social media promoter and a sacred cow. Carvin has written a new book about his experience called Distant Witness, Social Media, the Arab Spring, and a Journalism Revolution. And earlier this week, at an event at WNYC's Green Space, he joined me to talk about it. Somebody who was hearing about tonight's talk wrote on Twitter that she was having a journogasm.
That close to doing a spit take, so I'm glad I pulled that
That's
slowly.
Good. Sometimes you say you're a journalist, sometimes you say you're not a journalist. Pick a side.
I'm a storyteller who works at a news organization who commits acts of journalism.
As you've said, you tweet revolutions.
Yeah.
But you weren't in Tunisia on December 17th, 2010,
nope.
When the spark was lit that eventually consumed Egypt and Bahrain and Libya and Yemen and Syria. You weren't. And yet, you kind of were.
It's strange because as these revolutions spread, and I noticed a trend in which more and more people were tweeting to me, worrying about my safety. At one point, I was in Palm Springs, California at some type of TED event, and I decided to go sit outside by the pool, have myself a drink, and I pull up my phone, and I saw a tweet from someone that said something to the effect of, "My church and I are all praying for your safety in Libya." People do get confused sometimes, especially when I'm tweeting 100 times an hour or whatever and pulling together all these stories in real time. Yeah. Whereas, you know, much of the time I'm at a McDonald's play place with my kids and I've got my laptop there and talking about Syria.
So you knew Tunisia a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't live in the country. You
nope.
don't speak Arabic.
Nope.
You've never covered a war.
Nope.
I could go on.
Yeah.
But
completely unqualified for doing this.
Let us tick off some examples of how you dealt with those limitations. First, language. You saw a picture of a woman in Tunis holding a sign.
I assumed in this particular case that it was a protest slogan of some sort. So I asked one of these guys I knew on Twitter who was involved in protests, and I said, could you translate this for me? Before he could reply, a bunch of other people in the region did. And it really struck me at that moment that I don't need to be driving one or two people crazy on Twitter, asking them to answer one question after another. Instead, if I just share more openly what I know and what I don't know, someone out there will probably come out and have an answer.
And that picture is not a slogan at
all.
It
was the name of a young man who had been killed the day before.
Let's talk about culture. You wrote in your book about a heartbreaking example of cultural misinterpretation.
Yeah.
You tweeted a video of what you wrote was a wounded baby being treated in the hospital.
Right. So I saw that and I was actually relieved because I thought, okay, this child has survived. They're cleaning them, getting them ready for surgery, whatever. And I said something to that effect when I tweeted it. But within a minute or two, I started hearing from people all over the world saying, Andy, that child is dead. They're preparing him or her for burial. Which, of course, I knew. I knew that was part of the traditions that when you were going to perform an Islamic burial, you have to wash the body of the deceased.
And then you were horrified that you'd made a
mistake. I was mortified by it.
You want to talk a little bit about graphic pictures and graphic video and how you decide what to post?
There's been an enormous amount of unspeakable horrors that have been captured. I've had to spend a lot of my time going through a lot of footage trying to sort out what to share and what not to share. But ultimately, I made a decision early on that I wasn't going to censor myself simply because it was graphic. And I had a lot of people complain about that. They said, why are you sharing this? We would never post this on our website, or we would never put this as the lead story at our broadcast. Well, that's partially the point. There was a time when mass media, it was almost a family affair. You know, you'd all be sitting around the breakfast table reading the paper, and then you'd watch the evening news at night. It required a certain amount of discretion, knowing that there was a possibility kids might be watching it. Whereas on Twitter, I feel like people have made the choice to follow me, and I describe to them very bluntly what they're about to see. I don't say, hey, surprise, check this out. I'll say this is footage of a group of protesters who've been blown up by an anti-aircraft weapon.
There's no amount of expertise that you can't marshal in the Twittersphere.
Yeah.
You were trying to figure out the origins of a weapon, a missile that was fired by Gaddafi's forces against protesters.
Yeah, this was when the Libyan civil war kicked into high gear, and an Egyptian Twitter follower of mine sent me some tweets saying, hey, do you know what this thing is? He showed me one of these pictures, and he told me that there was a regional news service that said it was proof that Israel had supplied weapons to Gaddafi. And I thought, well, proof, what do you mean? Well, he said, look at the six-pointed star. And so I tweeted to my followers, let's say for a moment you're the Israeli government, and you wanted to supply Gaddafi with weapons. Would you honestly put a national and religious symbol on said weapons? And so my Twitter followers agreed it didn't make sense. They started searching a variety of databases and very quickly, like in a matter of minutes, figured out that this was some type of illumination round or star shell, which they shoot up in the sky at night. It sends off flares and it lights up the sky. They started finding ones manufactured in India, in the UK, in Eastern Europe. We eventually found a declassified NATO manual, and the six-pointed star was like on page 28. My Twitter followers and I, just by talking to each other, were able to sort this out rather quickly.
The weird thing is that you don't really know who most of these helpful people are. Like one of your ordnance experts
yeah.
was a guy named Knowles Van 2011.
That's
and
right.
Sometime later, he got in touch with you. I have to say, my jaw literally dropped.
Yeah, this guy was one of my go-to people for munitions. And I thought, well, this guy's probably ex-military or is currently active, but he isn't using his real name because of it. And then he contacted me and said, hey, I've been meaning to tell you a story. Can we talk privately? And we got on Skype together, and he started describing to me how he had put out a request on Twitter for volunteers, people who were ex-military or had medical backgrounds, to start putting together manuals for the rebels in Libya. Everything from how to dress a wound to how to dismantle an IED or how to clean an AK-47. And they produced something close to 50 of these manuals and had them all translated into Arabic and snuck into the country and distributed in the capital, in Misrata, and in the western mountains. And,
and rebels told you they had used
and
them.
Rebel, I talked to people after the fact, and they said, yeah, we used this
now,
stuff.
Now, you said you talked to him on Skype. Does that mean you saw him?
No, I didn't see him, but you know, I was listening to him. He had this really thick southern drawl, and he talked a bit about being a Seminoles fan. And I asked him, so did you go to Florida State? And he said, no, sir, I haven't. I'm in high school. And I said, really, you're in high school? Yeah, I'm 15 years old. Basically, he liked watching the Military Channel and the Discovery Channel, learned a lot from doing it. And he got soldiers and ex-special forces and doctors and all sorts of other people, plus made successful contact with people on the ground. And he was a kid. It's made me wonder, have the Arab revolutions been the real first time that people could volunteer in a very constructive, hands-on way without actually being there?
But it raises a crucial question. How do you decide who to trust?
Well, it certainly helps if you know someone on the ground to start with. There's one guy I knew in Egypt, and I went to his Twitter account, and I took a look at who he was following, and then I went all the way down to the bottom of the list to see who he followed first, because Twitter displays it in reverse chronological order. Checked out their Twitter accounts, followed some of them, and then went to the bottom of their list of followers and repeated that process several times. By the time the Egyptian revolution got 18 days into it and Mubarak was forced to resign, I had this group of a couple hundred people that represented a large part of the protest leadership who happened to be online.
The protest leadership, that's what dominated your coverage of the Arab Spring, not government statements. In other words,
right.
The trappings of balanced reporting weren't there.
Well, it's tough to do that when governments don't know what social media is. In the case of both Egypt and Tunisia, there was no social media presence as far as I could tell. And I can't make these people appear out of thin air. But then in the case of Bahrain is a very wired country. Like 80% of the population has internet access at home. You had a core group of protesters who were fighting against the government. You had people that were very, very supportive of the government. Sometimes they were members of the royal family. And then you had people in between that were sympathetic for the protesters, but were also concerned that the economy of the country was being permanently damaged. All of these discussions and fights played out online. On a few occasions when I would retweet government supporters, I would hear from supporters of protesters saying, how dare you retweet that government minister? You're buying into their propaganda. And I would write back and say, when did I become the PR mouthpiece for the protesters? Yeah, I'm trying to capture their stories, but there are other people who fundamentally disagree with them. And the fact that that's playing out online, I think it's even more important that I have to acknowledge that.
And then there were countries that had virtually no social media presence,
right.
Yemen being
Yemen's
one.
Yemen's a very good example of that.
As you tried to cover Yemen, you went through your usual practice of asking people to cite sources for the assertions they made, to provide some kind of confirmation
right.
when people posted things. And you got a message from somebody who wrote, please don't be so hard on us in public. We started reporting as of January with no training. Losing face and reputation is part of the Arabic culture, so messaging me in private would be greatly appreciated, and the same for most Yemenis, actually. I know you mean well. It's just a cultural thing. In other words, don't question my tweets in public.
Right. I was essentially questioning their honor, that they would not tell the truth.
And there were lots of bogus stories coming out of Libya, coming out of Syria.
I mean, there was this long track record of BS essentially being circulated all over the place. And so just asking people, who told you that, seems like a reasonable question to me. But they weren't used to it. And I had to back off a little bit, but then also tell them, if you want me to cover this story and you're tweeting about it, occasionally I'm going to have to ask you publicly. If you can tell me some of these things privately, that's great. But sometimes it's necessary to have these conversations in public. And after a while, we reached a sort of detente with each other.
Yemen was so hard to cover.
Yeah.
But there was some extraordinary video. This is snipers in the city of Taiz. Mm-hmm. There were countless videos like these in many countries shot on cell phones, uploaded to Facebook and YouTube. And I wonder how you vetted them, how you waded through them. This particular tape, you couldn't see anywhere else.
So what you're seeing here, there were protesters on the ground in the city of Taiz who had been marching and assembled in this square. And all of a sudden on these rooftops, snipers appeared. And not only were there snipers there, there appeared to be spotters saying, shoot that one there, shoot this one there. The body counts were extraordinary in this particular case. And you generally didn't see this stuff being reported in mainstream media because Yemen is so out in the middle of nowhere compared to a place like Egypt. And so the few people who were online suddenly became these conduits for video. As to verifying them, one thing that's unique about Yemen is its architecture. And so if you see these wide-angle shots of certain buildings, I may not be able to tell the difference between this city or that, but I can still tell it's Yemen. When I'd see footage like that, I would then share it with my Twitter followers and ask, do you know which city this is? And they would say, oh, that mountain that's in the distance, that's outside of Sana. Or they would point out a landmark to me.
Your tweeting was frequently emotional. You were mourning in public. You wore your heart on your Twitter sleeve.
Yep.
There was a guy named Mohammed Nabous, in Libya. You had an extraordinary admiration for him.
Somehow, this young man had set up a satellite connection and started broadcasting these live stream videos. And so he was basically like the first independent broadcast journalist to emerge in Libya in probably one or two generations.
Look at this. I mean, what can you call this? Isn't this attacking civilians? We are being attacked at our houses. Look at this wall. It's all down because of the missiles. You call everybody and ask them to watch this. They have to tweet. They have to tweet. The video is coming. The video is coming right now.
That was Mo early on the morning of March 19th, 2011. The Libyan government claimed that they were adhering to a ceasefire, and he was getting reports that there was fighting going on. And so he headed out in the wee hours of the morning with a camera in one hand and his cell phone in his lap, driving around town trying to find what was happening. I basically live tweeted him doing this up until like 1:30 East Coast time. And the next morning I got up and immediately saw that footage being broadcast on CNN. So I thought, wow, it's incredible. This guy actually documented an attack on Benghazi. And then I started hearing privately from another mutual acquaintance who said, Mo is dead. Around that moment, two other videos appeared on the live stream. One of them was audio that he had recorded of him being caught in a firefight. There's gunfire everywhere. He's giving a play-by-play of everything. And then all of a sudden you hear zing, and the audio cuts off. Absolute silence. And then I clicked the second video, and it was audio of his wife saying that he was killed in that fight. But she asked all his volunteers to continue because the story of Libya couldn't end with Mo's death. Just as I was watching that video, I saw the tweets go out from Reuters saying that France has started its first bombing run. Right around the time that Mo was killed, the first planes were fueling up in Europe.
And this is what Mo had been demanding.
Here was a guy who became a journalist because it was the only way he knew how to save his community. I was extremely upset, and I didn't hold back.
Which brings me to another of the Guardian columnist Michael Wolff's descriptions of you, mm-hmm. other than Sacred Cow. He also called you Empathy King.
Yeah. Whatever. I mean, social media has the word social in front of it for a reason, because you've got human beings interacting with each other, everything from talking about the news to sharing their latest cat videos. And I think all of it is valid and all of it is important. Cory Doctorow from the blog Boing Boing once described a lot of these things you see on Twitter as a form of social grooming, like you would see among chimps. It reminds us that we have these connections with each other. So when things suddenly hit the fan and things become important, those bonds are stronger than ever. I realized early on that the worst thing I could do on Twitter is act like a broadcast journalist in the most traditional sense, where I'm standing in front of a mic and saying everything perfectly with that perfect NPR voice. It's great for that medium, but that's because the people aren't talking back to you in real time. Why put on this so-called professional face when you can just be a person?
It's such a fascinating story, Andy. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Andy Carvin.
Thanks, everyone.
This was just part of an hour-long conversation that features more stories of the revolutions and a deeper exploration of the strengths and weaknesses of Twitter as a source of news. We discussed the criticism Carvin faced for retweeting misinformation following the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting and how to ensure that tweets of questions don't get retweeted as facts. You can see it all by checking out our blog at onthemedia.org.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Doug Anderson. This is Doug's last week with us, for now anyway, and we are going to miss this guy dearly. Doug, thank you. It's been a delight. We had more help from Krista Ripple, and the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Frankel.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.